What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, producer of 411 Teen. Joining me via phone, I welcome Willow Dia, editor of Igniting Brilliance, Integral Education for the 21st Century, an anthology of articles about integral education. The book is designed to inspire and empower teachers to utilize various methods in their classroom. Integral educators apply theory to encourage both personal development and academic rigor in the classroom. Welcome to 411 Teen, Willow.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. Looking forward to finding out all about integral education. What inspired the book?
Ultimately, children inspired the book. Their quality of life and an emerging conversation around having a more balanced and comprehensive approach to education that includes sort of the interiors, the insides of our beings and our experience, as well as sort of our educational outcomes. Mm-hmm. So there are many educators around the world who are very involved in a lively conversation about how to create this approach. And that's essentially what inspired it.
Now, is this approach applicable to all ages, or is it just for a specific age group?
It's absolutely applicable to all ages. In fact, one of our taglines is from cradle to cosmos. So it's definitely a lifelong learning process.
Okay. What was the goal or the basic premise upon which you were operating when you were developing this book?
You know, the goal was really simple. It was to provide a snapshot, a large overview of an emerging field globally. Mm-hmm. So there were 17 people who contributed altogether, and from places like Norway, Australia, Canada, the U.S. The idea was to share first-person narratives from educators who are engaging this practice in their classroom to show other educators and administrators and parents how they're doing what they're doing and why it works, how it works. So the core of the book are just short stories that share the impact of this approach.
Well, just what is integral education?
That's a great question. Essentially, it applies to the body, mind, and spirit in the context of self, nature, and culture. So the idea is to equip young people to navigate the complexities of the 21st century with grace and sort of empowered ease, but not without compromising or forsaking the need to be self-directed learners facing real challenges in real time. So the preparation is rigorous, and there's a lot of care given to attending to the infrastructure, the interior of each student. So having people be emotionally intelligent and socially intelligent is just as important to be effective currently as it ever has been and maybe more. So there's quite a balance of attention between love and challenge.
Now, would this particular approach be useful for all types of kids? I mean, kids who may have some developmental delays or some emotional problems, are there any groups that you would say this really does not apply well to?
Well, I particularly love that you asked that because my background is not as an educator. I'm rather an occupational therapist. So I've worked with kids with all kinds of diagnoses and issues and constraints to their learning, and there's never been a better approach. And the reason is that integral education accounts for every learner's type of learning. So Howard Gardner did a beautiful job of articulating eight native intelligences. And along any level of functional performance, one can learn from all of their senses in a present moment, given the right approach. So, no, it's absolutely inclusive of everyone at every performance level, every age, and every stage of development.
let's talk more about it so that I and my listening audience can kind of put our arms around it, grasp it. Just again, I mean, what does it involve? How does it differ from the traditional way that we educate kids now?
You know, it's the differences are both vast and really subtle. And so
okay.
to give you a practical
okay.
example, in a ninth grade botany class, you might approach the lesson plan from a systems perspective. And what I mean by that is a teacher might teach about coffee as both a plant as well as sort of a cultural ritual, mm-hmm. as well as part of a supply and demand chain, as well as a chemical that affects our physiology, as well as sort of a cultural centerpiece, if you will. So you can take one thing and expand upon it in any given systems perspective, and therein lies the trick. So it can stay two-dimensional, or you can really play with it and equip the kids to learn how to learn as they're encountering whatever the lesson is, whatever the object of the lesson is. Does that make sense?
Yes, I think so. Where is it being utilized?
It's being utilized all over the world in small ways, and also there are about, I think we have about 24 programs scattered about. So really it's been contingent at this point upon educators to not only learn about it, but sort of take it up and work with it and play with it. And I'd say there's a loose community of maybe 1,500 or 1,800 educators globally who connect with each other at an annual seminar. Mm-hmm. The next one's in Oslo in June. We'll be there teaching. There'll be other amazing educators offering what they do and sharing information about that. Yeah, essentially anyone obviously is welcome to join mm-hmm. this conversation. It's about changing education for both the teacher and the learners.
Well, you know, change is always very difficult to institute.
Yeah, it's true. There's a lot of immunity to change.
Yeah. And that was going to be my next question. How have people responded to, and I don't want just even people, how have educators and administrators in the United States responded to integral education?
I love that question. You know, traditional systems have a hard time accommodating change more so than independent systems.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
there are some amazing stories of, you know, high school teachers and middle high school teachers who worked with within the creative constraints of a public school system, did incredible transformative educational work for, you know, upwards of 30 years, and were then, you know, ousted from their systems. We also have case studies of people working in independent schools and really applying it from the top down and seeing incredible changes in the transparency of the culture, in sort of the experience that both teachers and learners have on a daily basis of the richness of education and falling in love with education mm-hmm. together as a group. So mm-hmm. there's a wide range, really, everything from public to private and even master's programs who are engaging in multimodal approaches.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned it was very effective and used with the self-directed student. What about those students who aren't self-directed?
Yeah, I mean, everybody has a different...
Mm-hmm.
Again, you're pointing to the resistance, and I love that because
right.
the fact is that within any system, we have to negotiate resistance. This book was not written for the public education system.
Mm-hmm.
I worked within public education systems as an OT for many years and quickly surmised that it's just not the place to create change unless you're willing to spend 20 to 50 years. So this book is really geared for independent educators and higher education and anyone willing to sort of take up the mantle of walking mm-hmm. through that as a public educator, and people do. But specifically, the aim was to create the opportunity for people with more bandwidth to really leverage that systemic permission to engage in widespread change. We see that happening. It's going well in some places. Of course, it's difficult. It's messy, you know. Change mm-hmm. is really messy. Anyone who's worked in a school knows how mm-hmm. the shadow side of a school is extraordinarily messy. So as a group of human beings, that's always going to be present. There's no denying that. It's more about acknowledging the negative and accentuating the positive and really mm-hmm. continuing with a consistency of practice so that we can engage with really with mastery eventually, and that takes practice.
Well, what I hear you saying, and you correct me if I'm wrong, is let's say a teacher was listening to this and their school had really not embraced integral education. They could themselves incorporate it into their classroom if they so desired. I mean, because it seems like it's multidimensional, multimodal, and so therefore a teacher can independently, utilize it. Right? Am I right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it can be alienating and wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
The invitation when teachers, and as they are actually taking this up, is to come and connect with other educators who are taking the same path.
Mm-hmm.
It's really rigorous. It's really inspiring. It's utterly brilliant when it's going well.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen lots of educators really have fun with it. I mean, it gets to be, it takes pedagogy from the sort of two-dimensional dryness that it can be, like any practice can mm-hmm. can be, to a much more live, engaged, personal engagement. Because a lot of the emphasis for teachers is to grow professionally and personally.
Mm-hmm.
It requires just profound engagement on a personal level.
What kind of changes have you observed in the students who are in the integral education community?
I this is my favorite part. The kids really are magnetic and enlivened anyway, right? Just as most young kids, if they're healthy, are pretty darn happy,
mm-hmm.
unless they're encountering some amazing challenge. In a context like this, kids literally fall in love with learning because they're feeling safer and they're
mm-hmm.
feeling safe to learn and not as psychically defended in the hallways and more relaxed. And more communicative.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's still middle school and high school, and I mean, of course, there are barriers to learning. Of course, there's resistance and challenge. It's not to negate that, the fact that education can be an agitator. It's more to acknowledge that what we see is that people light up and they access states of flow and creativity and joy that you typically don't see in other systems. And that's what gets me out of bed in the morning, frankly. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I think that's what matters the most to me is that kids have a high-quality life. It's not just, life doesn't stop when you go to school. It's
mm-hmm.
just light up more when you go to school.
Talk to us about the contributors to the book. How were they selected? What's some of their backgrounds? And I know it's a real, very motley, in a positive way, not negative, mm-hmm. group. I mean, just in looking at the contributor list, but I wondered if you would share them with the listening audience.
Sure. Each of the contributors was generous and incredible enough to offer their time voluntarily. They were largely a part of integral education many for many years prior to my arrival to that conversation. There was some intent to creating this book. I happened to encounter that intention and have the opportunity to sort of make it real. These folks come from really Florida, Philadelphia, BC, Oslo, Perth, Tasmania, from all kinds of unique educational backgrounds themselves, unique religious tendencies or, you know, cultural backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
And each one of them has dedicated themselves to being a continuous learner in their lifetime and mastering education as a practice. And each one of them was willing to just share a story or write a chapter or bring forward whatever morsel they cared most about. It was quite self-organized, quite volunteer-based, and they were solicited by invitation and largely really by proximity. We were all in the same seminar. A few of them were known by others and invited, and it was a very simple process.
Oh, okay. So everybody was on the same page in the same mindset.
Yeah, pretty much. Yep.
Okay. All right. I've been talking with Willow Dia in Austin, Texas. She's the editor of Igniting Brilliance, Integral Education for the 21st Century. We're going to take a break, but I'll get right back at you. Next week on 411 Teen, should what we eat be the government's business? Hoping to promote healthier eating habits and provide better choices, Los Angeles has banned new fast food outlets in a part of the city in low income and high in diabetes and obesity. Is the government going beyond its role? Tune in to 411 Teen Sunday afternoon at 2 on 88.9 FM. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, and I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, producer. This hour, I'm talking with Willow Dia, editor of Igniting Brilliance, Integral Education for the 21st Century. Willow, you still there?
Yes.
Okay. Right. you had mentioned that you were an occupational therapist, and so you come to education from a different perspective. Do you find that integral education works equally as well with those who may have some issues with learning?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. A lot of the work I did as an OT in schools was integrally informed, and OT by its nature is fairly integral, so including multiple senses, addressing educational needs at really specific functional performance levels and really specific developmental levels has the OT or the teacher customize learning activities and exercises that are, I mean, highly specific to the individual. Mm-hmm. So, and of course, you're including what integral means, and I should add a little bit of color to this, is that we include the subjective experience, the interior experience of the student and the teacher. We also take a look at the behavior of the student, the outcomes, you know, sort of the how they demonstrate their capacity and their learning, their cultural proclivity and background and mood and conversation and values, all within a system that hopefully is designed to enable and empower their capacity as a student or a teacher. It's not always the case, obviously. We've all been in schools where the physical environment leaves much to be desired. But within the constraints of the physical environment and the arrangement of the physical environment, there's a lot that can be done to bring life to a moment in which information is being exchanged.
Do you mind just sharing an example with the listening audience just so they can get a feel?
That's fun for me.
Okay.
Yeah, I worked with a little guy in Menlo Park some years ago, probably almost 8 years ago now, and he was really bright, and his eyes didn't work so well together to read, and his fine motor skills were not the greatest. And just so bright that he was just sparkling with energy all day long, kind of hyper. And I would have this, I worked in a little portable, which is sort of on campus, you know, there was an expansion on campus, and I would take him to this room, and essentially he needed to move his body before he could focus. And this wasn't somebody with ADD, this was just somebody who needed to move to regulate his nervous system. So we would do jumping jacks, and we would do push-ups, and we would roll on the ground, and we'd jump rope and sort of get him grounded again in his body after having sat in a chair for several hours. And then I would put out a couple of choices of activities, knowing that they were, you know, exactly what he needed to be doing therapeutically, but also stuff that he liked, that he was motivated to do. So leveraging his inherent interest, but gauging the activity and grading the activity, and I don't mean grading it like A, B, C, D, but calibrating the activity so that his nervous system got what it needed to integrate. My job was to help him integrate. So he got to choose. He got to play with and tell stories about whatever the activity was, because it was the physical activity was secondary to the narratives we would make up together doing it. And it was always... I mean, I can't even tell you about how much fun I had just being with him in these stories that we would create while he was healing, you know, while he was integrating. So at the end of 50 minutes together, there would be a visible measure of therapeutic sort of integration and tiredness, really. It's a lot of work to do all that. And over the course of the year, I just saw him blossom, just beautiful. And I think it just takes a little sensitivity to do this. It's not a big deal in so many ways. It's just small, subtle considerations mm-hmm. from around the culture, the interior, the behavior, and the systems. Those are sort of the four quadrants, the four lenses that we look through. Mm-hmm. And as long as you were considering those, you know, it kind of handles itself in a certain way.
How long have you been involved in this integral community?
You know, I was sort of an introvert when I first started reading integral stuff in 95. So I don't know how many years that is. 17 years?
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? I don't know. A while. I really was reading on my own for quite a while. Then I joined a little study group, and I was still too sort of shy to go to any of the workshops. And then really the first workshop I went to was this integral education seminar on Whidbey Island. I think that was 2007. And I recognized my colleagues. You know, I recognized these were people who were personally developed, professionally developed, really playful, really well-rounded, mm-hmm. spiritually inclined, and just masterful in their field. And I just wanted to be around it. It was really clear. There's a lot of balance in these folks.
Well, it's clear from your voice that you're really excited and committed to it.
Yeah. Yeah, it thoroughly excites me. It's all I want to do. Well, I really appreciate the opportunity to share it with you, too.
Oh, well, thanks. In education, of course, we always have to talk about assessment. Now, is assessment accomplished in a different way when you use the integral education? I mean, depending
on the curriculum content, depending on the age of the student, depending on sort of the bias of the teacher, mm-hmm. you can design assessments that include peer-to-peer work or dialogue, self-assessment, and regular sort of scoring of a more standardized test or a topic-specific test.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most groundbreaking assessment that I'm aware of right now is the lectical assessments that are being developed out of Harvard. And I'm forgetting their website now. I think it's devtest.org, devtestservice.org.
Well, okay.
I'm blowing it, I'm sure. But basically, they build the building blocks so that teachers have really specific pathways for knowledge within the topic. So if you're teaching history to eighth graders and they come into eighth grade missing some of the building blocks, you mm-hmm. get to understand that right away and work in a really customized way with that child to build that line of knowledge so that they can perform at the eighth grade level.
Okay.
So it sort of accounts for the fact that some kids might not have been all that present in seventh grade for the earlier piece.
Mm-hmm.
And then the teacher gets like a graph of their current class and who knows what and who doesn't.
Okay. Okay.
And exactly how to bridge them into the present class.
Okay.
Kind of helpful,
mm-hmm.
you know.
What about the cost involved? I mean, say a teacher is listening or a school, a principal is listening, and they would be interested in trying to transition. I mean, what would that involve? I mean, are there training modules? How would they go about that?
Yeah, I love that you asked that. That's one of the inquiries that we're in, is creating the conditions for educators to shift and have teleclasses and even a certification course to engage with. At the present moment, they can attend a seminar, they can read a book, they can engage with, you know, the community in a forum. I'm actually in the process right now of developing courses for educators to sort of roll them out in about a month. I really want to create the conditions along with some of my colleagues for people to engage in a semi-structured way with a lot of one-on-one coaching to come out with a solid sense of competency. And it's in process. We'll let you know when it's done, actually.
For my listening audience, how can they connect with you, or is there a website? Would you share that with us?
Yeah, it's metaintegral.org.
Okay.
That's one of the ways that site is being built right now. Currently, mm-hmm. you can also go to Integral Education Center, which is located at ignitingbrilliance.com.
Okay. All right, thank you. And I'll probably ask again later on in the program. You know, people never get everything when you say it one time. So
it's Igniting Brilliance, like the name of the book,
mm-hmm.
ignitingbrilliance.com.
Okay, ignitingbrilliance.com. As we look at the American educational system, would you just kind of share your assessment of where we're at and what's happening with our American system?
Do you mean specifically the public education
system? Public, yeah. I certainly do.
I might expose my bias here.
That's all right. That's all right. I mean, you know, what we want is diversity, so we want to hear where you're coming from.
Yeah, well, here's where I'm really coming from. I think teachers are some of the most visionary, most powerful people on the mm-hmm. most noble path. I don't think public education does those good-hearted people any justice. And at this point, I really want us to start from scratch. I know that's not possible.
Mm-hmm.
I do know that all of the kids who are engaged in public education, not all of them are having a horrible experience. Many are having a great experience. And we are not leveraging the capacity of that system well enough for me to feel, like, happy about it. I just have seen way too many kids sort of lose touch with who they are, what they love, what they're passionate about, what motivates them, and it's just too sad to watch that happen. I think there is a way that we can start from scratch in independent settings, and then get that practice lab really happy and duplicate it. And that's really what I'd like to see happen in my lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like for the allocation of funds to include public education, you know, kids who can't afford private school, such that there's a distribution of those funds and schools are created, maybe they're charter schools at that point, wherein people can engage in integral education no matter what socioeconomic
mm-hmm.
status they're
mm-hmm.
living within. Does that make any sense?
Yes. Yes, it does.
I want there to be a tipping point, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to start with independent school systems because that's where we have the bandwidth to do it. I really don't think the public education system is going anywhere fast. And frankly, I think we waste a lot of money on trying to fix it,
mm-hmm.
you know.
If you were going to identify maybe three major issues within the public education system, as you see them, what would they be?
Lack of character education stands out pretty profoundly for me. There's a way in which the system itself doesn't allow for creativity as to
mm-hmm.
be the core of the pedagogy.
Mm-hmm.
Creativity is absolutely essential right now. It needs to be at the center point of every educational curriculum, and it needs to be sort of the center of the wheel around which everything spins.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see that happening necessarily.
It's almost an oxymoron.
When
you say creativity in public education, I just don't see it encouraged. Or I'm sure there are some programs, but I would say overall, I don't see creativity encouraged, but I don't think the way that the schools are set up and the classrooms are set up, they can encourage it.
Agreed. It's systemically entrenched to the extent there's sort of a dullness that's just sort of guaranteed. It's just so sad because it just absolutely doesn't have to be that way. And then the buildings themselves are kind of oppressive. You know, there's something about the qualities of the good and true and beautiful that don't occur on a daily basis in school except in the eyes of the children themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is a major loss for the teachers and the students. Because if teachers could go to a beautifully designed environment in which the transparency of the culture is actually empowering them to enact their values and embody their deepest wisdom. And we're not excluding our innermost sort of beings. And I know that I'm actually all for the separation of church and state.
Mm-hmm.
I still think there's a universality to engaging with life from a sense of wonder that you could call spirituality that should be welcome in the school. And I think that piece gets snuffed out really early.
Yeah.
And because it does, it leaves us in this very fragmented place. So even the practice of relaxing for 5 minutes before classes start would do a tremendous amount to unify a classroom before they engage in learning, for example.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing spiritual or religious about relaxing and centering, you know, or meditating.
Right.
So I think there's ways to tweak the system in very
still,
small, subtle ways
mm-hmm.
that don't require any money,
mm-hmm.
That would create very different results.
In this, I would say, I guess in this competitive, technologically advanced world,
mm-hmm.
do you think kids are growing up too fast? I mean, your opinion, is there an overexposure to sex? You know, is there a growing disrespect for life? Because those are kind of the opposite of what you are talking about. You're talking about having a respect for life, having a sensitivity to life. So I'm just wondering if you find that our world today is kind of antithetical to what you're talking about.
You know, I trust the way the world is today, and that's going to sound very passive and very sort of overly accepting. The kids actually do have to encounter the difficulties, challenges, and sort of the precipice in which our times reside. That being said, they absolutely don't have to be overexposed to violence or, you know, nudity or anything inappropriate. And I think it's up to both schools and parents to monitor that, obviously. But in a very generalized sense, do I think kids are growing up too fast? That's really hard to answer because it really depends on the family, the school, the area that they're growing up in. You know, kids here in Austin are in an urban context. They're certainly exposed to much more sort of illicit or dangerous or sort of adult behavior than other kids could be. Mm-hmm. But again, that's totally up to the supervision of both the school and the parents. So case by case is my answer to that.
Okay.
There's always the opportunity to grow up too fast, you know, whether you're in a rural setting or not.
I ask that because so often when you hear discussions about education and development of children, one comment is always made that the children are, this world is too hectic, too involved, and the kids are growing too fast. And I just wondered if you were of that mindset, where you sat as far as that was concerned.
I think kids are really powerful people, and as long as we're protecting them appropriately and allowing them to integrate technology, that technology is never going away. I mean, in fact, we don't know what jobs will exist when the current high schoolers graduate, and we don't know what technology they'll be using to engage in those jobs. So, I mean, within 2 to 5 years, we're going to see new fields emerging, new technological instruments to support those fields. And so to blame technology for overexposure, I don't buy it. I think technology could actually help us crowdsource the answers to a lot of our planetary issues and governmental issues and economic issues. And I think Jane, is it McDougal?
Jane McDougal.
TED Talk, and I actually agree that we can leverage kids' natural interest in technology to solve complex problems, and I think we should be doing that, not to the detriment of their well-being, you know, again, with balance.
Okay.
But, yeah.
Well, hold your thoughts for 1 minute. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a break, but we'll return momentarily. What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and I'm having a very informative discussion with Willow Dia. Willow is the editor of Igniting Brilliance, Integral Education for the 21st Century. Willow, as we look at education and teachers, and that's what the focus is today, what changes would you recommend in teacher training?
I love that question. Here's what I would change, and it's one word. The observer, the teacher herself, himself.
Okay.
The most powerful impact we have as adults is to transmit our deepest knowing all the time. And that means the acquisition of skills, of course. That means absolutely gaining mastery in the field through practice, but primarily it also means that we're not projecting our distress on our students. It means we're caring well enough for our own emotional lives and spiritual lives and physical well-being that we're showing up as a model, and this is sounds trite, mm-hmm. very few people do this, really taking care of body, mind, and spirit so that when we show up, we're whole and full and ready and engaged and alive. Like, that's really useful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We need alive people in the world, and so we need kids to be engaging with alive teachers.
Okay.
That's a very short way to say it.
Okay. All right. As we look at teachers and we look at what we're trying to accomplish in the classroom, one thing that is often identified as an area that we need to enhance possibly is critical thinking. How do we teach critical thinking? Can we teach critical thinking?
Absolutely. Again, critical thinking comes from a regular practice of both self-reflection and peer reflection mm-hmm. and an awareness of the systems in which everything operates. So if you're talking about nature, you have to look at the whole ecological system. If you're talking about recycling, you have to look at those systems. How do we process waste? You know, like this. So taking the lens and broadening it out. That's the short answer to that one.
Okay. You know, today the media is an integral part of education, particularly the social media. What role do you feel social media should play in education?
That's a great question. I think that's still being discovered. Mm-hmm. I don't know that we have great research about that. What I've witnessed in school last year was that tweeting in a class can be really great. It can be very stimulating for students to give teachers feedback during class. It can also be highly distracting. Depends on the content, depends on the agreements that the classroom has with the teacher, depends on the students. So I think with the right agreements in the right classroom with the right sort of objective, mm-hmm. the use of social media, it can be really great and really powerful. I think one of the most powerful uses of social media that I've seen is for students to debrief the ways in which their teacher taught right after a class so that kids are empowered to say, hey, this really worked well, this didn't, thanks for doing such a great job, or here's what I'd like to see tomorrow, such that teachers are learning hour by hour how to be better mm-hmm. teachers for students. And that could be tweeted and, you know, collected later, harvested at the end of a workday. And that's another way to do it. So it depends, again, on the context mm-hmm. and the agreements.
Well, as we look at these new technologies, we know that they profoundly alter the way knowledge is conveyed. I mean, I'm thinking about how this impacts the use of textbooks. Will we still be using textbooks? We now have electronic books and mobile devices and game-based mm-hmm. stuff. Talk about that.
Well, as somebody who loves books, like libraries mm-hmm. were my first cathedral, I still have to admit that I think that books are probably going to, you know, become passé. I don't know when. I mean, I think that some of us old people will cling to our beautiful pages, you know, as long as we possibly can. And, you know, the kinesthetic experience of reading a physical book is very different.
Yeah.
But in terms of the amount of information we can carry around, it's kind of a given that they're going away eventually. I guess we'll see. It'll be interesting to see how it goes.
Do you feel that the United States suffers from what they call an educational deficit? I mean, so often we hear about our students lagging behind in particular areas, math, science.
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't think the deficit is educational. I think the deficit is more personal than that. Of course it's systemic, right? I think we have to point the finger at the system itself, and everybody's great at doing that. That doesn't solve anything. This is such a tricky one because it's about what we're comparing ourselves to,
mm-hmm.
and it's also about identifying what we really want for our mm-hmm. future and for our young people's future. So if you're talking about a global economic sort of political sphere of competition,
mm-hmm.
are there deficits with respect to China and India and the ways in which they score on tests? Absolutely. Are we behind? Yes.
Yeah.
Is that important on a global scale? Yes, if mm-hmm. we're invested in continuing the system the way it is. And I actually think that. You can slice it any way. You know, you can slice it socially, culturally, mm-hmm. sort of intellectually. I think the most important question is what's underlying that what we're calling it, what we're judging as a deficit.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's this profound disconnect between what we love and what we're doing in school. It's that simple. Kids love to learn. From the minute they're born, they're learning and they're just absorbing. It's when we disconnect them from that love over, you know, a period of time that we see this sort of despondent, apathetic, kind of depressed, sort of checked outness that's a result of having a fragmented picture given to you every single day. There's just nothing holifying. So if the deficit is anything, it's wholeness.
Mm-hmm. You know, we rely so much today on, I guess, passive learning. And your integral education is not, as I hear it, as I understand it from what I've read, is not a passive learning. Do you see this whole passive learning style changing? And if so, how do you see it?
Oh, absolutely. So self-directed learning it starts off being inherent, and then you can implement it through a system. If you're implementing like a curricular platform in a school, and you're not giving paper handouts to students every day about what, you know, what their assignments are, they have to carry their computer around and go after their assignments online and check their teacher's notes and turn their assignments in online.
Mm-hmm.
It requires a completely different muscle than we were given as students, in which everything was force-fed. So do I think that's important? It's essential, because in life now, we have to go after what we want to learn. And hopefully we continue to sort of foster and cultivate that love of learning and in life as adults, such that students are encouraged to sort of take that up as a practice. I know it's happening in a lot of schools actually are implementing that sort of style, and I think it's transitional, probably in this decade. I'm guessing that by the next decade, most of the systems will be set up for more self-directed learning.
Okay, so the education online program. Go ahead.
Requiring kids to show up and manage their time and manage their energy and manage their work and collaborate together and set up the social systems they need to be effective and to communicate effectively with their teachers. There's a lot of skills there.
Well, I've heard some refer to and explore the concept of a universal curriculum. How do you feel about that? For the United States, let's say, a universal curriculum.
I'm not sure what you mean by a universal curriculum.
Well, you would have standards and all school systems would teach the same and be able to meet, you know, these identified, pre-identified standards. Everybody's learning the same thing, you know.
We can go from one school system to another
and find that history was taught one way in school system B, but you go to another system and history is taught altogether different. Yet they still have to take and perform on a standardized test. So that's what I mean by universal.
I think having universal standards isn't a bad idea. I think testing at unrealistic levels is a terrible idea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think that as long as we're all human and we're uniquely expressing our gifts and our capacities every day at different levels, then even a universal curriculum is going to reflect something that's dead and static and stagnant.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sort of fundamentally opposed to something that's just somebody's idea of good. And yet I can see the value of having some sort of agreement around what kids should be exposed to.
Mm-hmm.
So I think therein lies a middle path. And I do think that, like, international baccalaureate programs are pretty successful.
Yeah.
But they, again, work within unique systems to sort of gain alignment around a set of principles and a core curriculum. That's really different than transposing some blanket called, like, a universal curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it certainly does. How do we reach, though, a democratic education? And by that, I mean one with access for all children. We know that the media is going to social media. Online programs are going to play a much more significant role than they even play today. But how do we access this for kids of all socioeconomic status. What do we do?
I think there's one word. I think it's philanthrocapitalism. You know, I think we leverage the incredible prosperity we have to allocate the resources to the children throughout the world who don't have that. And I know there are beautiful programs already, you know, well implemented, giving kids laptops for less than $100. Mm-hmm. I think they're down to 50 or something now all through India. I know that there are kids here in Austin who are funding other kids' learning experiences in places like Quito, Ecuador, and I think Kenya and South Africa. Mm-hmm. So I think there are all kinds of nonprofit solutions to doing that. And again, self-organized, grassroots largely, but utilizing the prosperity in any industrialized country to fund the kids in other countries would be probably the fastest way to take care of that.
Well, one group we haven't addressed, and they are very important, are the parents.
Yes. I'm glad you
picked that. They are very important. What role does the parent play in integral education?
You know, I think they get to play several roles. I think, obviously, they have to stay parents. Like, that's their most important role. That's primary. I think one of the opportunities of being a parent who's integrally engaged is that they're also engaged in their personal growth and well-being and modeling that and, you know, helping to foster learning about communication and finances and taking care of oneself and acquiring the skills that we all need to engage in the world. I think, though, that parents can partner with their students to provide sort of access to information at the right time and in the right way, so sort of a tour guide role. I also think that some parents have the capacity to be really mentors to their kids in different domains of life, and I think that's up to the parent and up to their sort of their vocation. But I see it as a pretty multifaceted opportunity there. Again, primarily being the parent, though.
Yeah.
Nothing replaces a good parent.
But some of that is in opposition to what we're doing today, because a lot of schools really, even though they verbalize we want parents, they really do not encourage parent involvement. So how do we work around that? You know, I mean, they don't really want parents stopping by. If you stop by, you have to give them notice and all of that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think it's funny because, again, this is where we could design it really differently. Mm-hmm. I have yet to see a perfect design for including parents in education. I think there are lots of partial designs, and, you know, it's fun. I'm going to work on that. I love that you brought that up because I haven't given it full consideration. And I think there's definitely some sort of, not a workflow, but almost like a streamlined process that could be articulated and iterated over time based on models that exist and are working to see what the best, well, and clearly based on the school, what the best ways are to engage parents. I mean, some of it's going to be volunteer, some of it's going to be real engagement in the classroom, depending on their student. I don't know. I'm going to think about that. I love your question.
All right. Can you share for my listening audience, for parents who may be tuned in, how they may incorporate the integral education community techniques just in their interaction and what they do with their kids? Can you give them a couple examples, a couple techniques that they may utilize?
You mean practical applications in the classroom?
Practical application, exactly.
You know, a real simple and very humbling one can simply be to ask for feedback from your students about your teaching. Very powerful. At the end of a class, leave 5 minutes of time if you can and ask how it was. And specifically ask the kids that are withdrawn or holding back or more shy, as well as the kids that are fully participating and engaged. Try to look for a whole spectrum of participation and attendance. And then really actually integrate it. Like, do it. And see what happens. It might be surprising. That's one. The other one is to mix it up methodologically. So if you've been doing lectures, do something else. Go outside. And I don't mean like a huge field trip. Just find another way to engage the imagination around the topic. Maybe it's a movie. Maybe it's a song. Maybe you have them do some research online and come up with the topic along the curriculum objectives. Just keep it fresh. I think that goes a long way.
In these last few minutes, I want to pick your mind about a couple of things. How do you feel about tenured teachers? Well, I can tell from that response.
Oh, God. That's a loaded question. Well, how do I feel about that?
I mean,
to attain tenure. I mean, people work really hard.
Yes.
Tooth and nail to get tenure. Is it always good to keep people in a tenured position when they're not functioning well? No. It's like, would you do that in a company? And I've sort of taken a very capitalistic look at education in the last couple of years and reinvigorated my interest in education through the eyes of business, because you would never keep someone on board that wasn't producing outstanding results. It's just that simple. And if the mission of the school is compromised because somebody's on tenure, even in a very partial way, then you have a performance evaluation and you reevaluate tenure. And I think that could be built into the system. You know, tenure is dependent upon continued upward development of the professional and of the results they're creating for their students. So I guess that isn't tenure by definition. So I guess my answer is no.
Okay.
Long version to a no.
Well, before we close, would you just share your website address again?
Sure. It's ignitingbrilliance.com.
Okay. Willow, it has been real. Thanks so much for the interview. To my listening audience, tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. This edition of 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Many thanks to our panelists for the stimulating discussion. Audio copies of 411 Teen are available, and if you would like to participate in the program or suggest discussion topics, call toll-free 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. That's 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. To subscribe to the 411 Teen podcast, log on to WFSU.org.